KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I like to think of the theaters in this town and this country as the storytellers who tell these stories over and over and help remind us who we are and who we can be.
It's terribly unfair. And there have got to be other and better ways to finance our highway system.
I think I spoke my mind and I told the truth. I told some truths that you couldn't even find on a computer machine.
I've been on the right trail, but I must be the wrong call.
That was Dr. John, Mac Rebenek. We're going to hear from him in a little bit. We're also going to find out more about a theater that's taking on parenting in a special performance. And we're going to look at the case for tolling. The hearings this week in Mercer Island and Bellevue were loud, and people were overwhelmingly opposed to tolling. Last night, there was a hearing in the Seattle area. It was reportedly a little quieter. People were not as opposed to tolling. But we heard the case against tolling at those public hearings, and we were just wondering for a little bit, what's the case for tolling? Craig Stone is Toll Division Director at the Washington State Department of Transportation.
Well, when you think about it, we're in this situation here. We have a lot of water bodies, and if you look around the country, San Francisco Bay, you know, Virginia area, up even into New York, we need bridges across Puget Sound. Ferries are part of our bridges across Puget Sound. Lake Washington is a huge body of water. How do you pay for these major transportation facilities? We've grown up. 520 is a lifeline for us, and it was vulnerable. It was vulnerable to earthquakes. It was vulnerable to major windstorms and damages. So placing the bridge, we're doing improvements, but we still have that final $1.4 billion to get across the Portage Bay area and tie into Interstate 5. So the question then comes down to, how do you finance it? How do you do that? So we're looking at trips across Lake Washington. There really are a single corridor. Those two bridges are only 3.5 miles apart. They interact with each other dramatically. And when you look at this, you're saying, how do we afford, how do we invest into our transportation infrastructure?
People do not accept that notion that this is a single corridor, though.
And that's true. That's true. And that's been part of this. The key question here is, how do you say that, well, Interstate 90 was built with federal dollars as an interstate, it should be held that way. We've also got to look at the future and say, how are we managing our system for the future from the standpoint of we have population growth, it's important to our economy, and the consequences if we don't get the last part of 520 improved, if we had a major earthquake event in the last Portage Bay, we would have a transportation disaster in this region. So there's some stewardship of how we move forward. The other part of it is you look at our transportation system, everything interacts. And if you look across Lake Washington, if you're going from East King County over to the Seattle area, a lot of people choose which bridge they want to go on. We knew when we tolled 520 we would see diversion traffic. That did occur. We have about 15,000 more trips a day going across I-90. That's created a lot more traffic congestion on I-90. By putting tolls on both bridges, you can balance that traffic again. You can actually improve traffic movement and help improve the traffic system in this region.
Well, people are avoiding the tolls on 520 because they don't want to pay them. Isn't that logical?
Well, there's two sides to tolls. There's an interesting part of it. One part is that you look at tolls. We've built 14 bridges in this state in our history with tolls. So when you have these major projects, major investments, the direct users, you know, using that to get across these bodies of water, it's been something we have used. When you look at the standpoint of how I-90 and 520 work together, they really are a system trying to get us across that body of water, and how do we invest into them is really what it comes down to.
When you
look at the alternatives, it's been part of our challenge. Federal dollars are basically drying up. You're looking at the Federal Highway Trust Fund is being near empty and broke, so the states are being called upon to do their improvements as opposed to the federal. And then you look at the standpoint of back in 2007, we had the opportunity in the three-county area for a roads and transit vote, and we voted it down, but that would have put $1 billion towards 520. And so now the question is, if not federal sources or those other sources, then should we be looking at tolls?
Well, Craig Stone, as toll division director, you think about this all the time, but you make the argument for a whole systems approach. Doesn't it just make the argument that the roads need to be paid for in a more whole systems way? And people have talked about, well, then increase the gas tax or increase other sales tax or put on a carbon tax, but if people have more efficient cars, or put on a mileage travel tax. Is that where we're heading?
Well, those are all discussions. What we do know is federal gas tax is going down, even the state gas tax. Since 2001, we've lost 47% of the buying power. The gas tax does not go up when fuel prices go up. In fact, better gas economy, we're going up towards 54 miles per gallon in the future, electric cars. So the gas tax in itself is really getting to be a dated approach. So people are looking at different approaches. Obviously, tolling is a very specific for a facility. There are longer range discussions about, though, what about a different way, which is the vehicle mileage. That is a longer term debate that I think has to happen at a national level.
That's Craig Stone, Toll Division Director of the Washington State Department of Transportation. There'll be more public hearings in Bellevue and around town and around the region. Then the DOT will come up with a draft proposal. There'll be more fall public hearings. It'll be presented to the legislature, where the legislature will have to make some decisions about how to pay for 520, I-90, and all the other roads that are in disrepair. Doug McDonald is the former State Secretary of Transportation and a Crosscut writer. He's been thinking about these things as well. All right, first of all, just the biggest of big pictures.
Well, first of all, if you read the headlines about these hearings, you've got to pick up the backstory. And the backstory is that the legislature and Governor Gregoire have been working on the problem of how to pay for these improvements, and particularly the 520 bridge, which is really crucial to finish. I mean, you need $1.4 billion or $1.3 billion to finish that job. We've got to get it together. There's no provision for it now. So that's the first question, how are you going to do it? And this tolling proposal on I-90 has been in the mix now for years. And what's actually happening in these hearings is it's a sounding board for people to give ideas and criticism so that the legislature, and eventually Governor Inslee is going to have to step into this, and make some decisions this year, more likely next year, about what will actually happen with those tolls.
Why start a project if you don't have the money? Don't we just blackmail all the people who don't want tolls but now are forced to finish a project that's halfway done?
If you ask that question about 520, the answer is that the only way you were going to start the project and get it done was to do the piece of it that was most vulnerable, which is the bridge, which is now being constructed. And then you've still got to figure out how to get it from Montlake to I-5. But if you waited until the entire thing was funded, you were going to wait until it fell in. And that was not a sensible approach, although you can certainly make the case for it. But if you want to get anything done in this environment, you've got to take pieces of projects that are achievable and get them underway.
Wasn't it clear to most people that when 520 tolls were put on, that it was just a precursor to having to toll and wanting to toll I-92?
If that's a personal question to me, the answer is it was absolutely clear, and I think it's been
clear.
Well,
when you were back thinking as an official, when
I was the Secretary of Transportation, it was clear. I think what's been difficult about this entire process is that the legislature has felt it necessary to move slowly and try to bring public opinion along with it. And I think, you know, one of the questions here is this is a little bit like going to Vashon Island and asking people on Vashon Island whether they'd like higher ferry fares. And the answer is no, probably not. And so you don't answer the question of what is the best solution for the overall mix of funding to get people back and forth across Lake Washington just by going to Mercer Island, which is not to say the Mercer Island views aren't important and are going to have to be taken into concern, but there's a bigger regional issue here, and it has to be solved looking at the regional resources and asking who should pay. And that could include and should include people on Mercer Island, in my view.
By the way, how was it solved in the past when I-90 was tolled? How did they deal with the Mercer Islanders who said, look, we have to go every day, we're trapped here, why should we have to pay every day more tolls?
You know, it's probably a little known fact, I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but my 50th anniversary class reunion for Mercer Island High School is coming up in June. So I was there not very much after the tolls actually came off what was then the Interstate 10, the Sunset Bridge. And of course people on Mercer Island paid.
Every time they went?
Sure.
Is it what? Is the argument akin to people live on the other side of the Tacoma Narrows, the Gig Harbor?
All these arguments are related, but it's particularly related to people who live on the other side of Puget Sound and ride the ferry system. And this is not to say that these adjustments don't require some thinking and some modification. They have to work for people and work well. But if you bought a house on Mercer Island in the last 8 years or 7 years, if you'd read the newspapers, you would have figured out that the likelihood that the transportation was not going to be an issue in your future about how you were going to get to your job in Seattle. That's like people who bought their houses under an airplane, airport runway. This has been coming for years, and so now the question is, how do we get to something that will work? But it will require leadership from the legislature and Governor Inslee, and what's happening now is really just the warm-up to where those decisions will really be made.
What are we talking about? Let's talk the big picture. This is, your co-crosscut writer, Knute Berger, has written about concern over the fact that eventually we're just going to be paying for roads in a different way. We're all going to be driving on tolled roads. 405, 522, 520, I-5, I-90. I don't know, city streets. As Sir Mix-a-Lot left our studio the other day, they're going to toll I-90. What's next? They're going to toll my fridge?
Well, one of the things that would be useful would be to talk about where this really could go rather than only doing it piecemeal, as I think has unfortunately been done on the Cross Lake Washington position. And that is going to require more tolling, unless what you want alternatively is a sky-high gas tax, much higher than we want today.
Well, what about the other taxes? Carbon tax, mileage tax?
I think carbon tax is interesting. I think eventually going to some kind of a vehicle miles travel tax makes a lot of sense. These are not going to happen quickly. And the need for money is not just about the 520. I've been working on this last summer quite a lot. The most compelling need for money is something everybody recognizes, which is that our roads are starting to fall apart from under attention to getting them repaved, to fixing the bridges. You can see that on the state roads. You can see that on I-5, which in my view is the biggest problem of all. And we are going to have to figure out how to step up. Tolling is a reasonable partial solution to that.
But didn't we step up recently? I know the last one failed, but didn't we pass some laws to improve the roads?
Road investment programs were passed in 2003 and 2005, and a major Sound Transit package was passed in 2008. But those projects those investments were all specified by the legislature to go to about, on WSDOT's case, about 400 projects, not to provide for projects in the future because the money was all bonded out. So there's no continuing stream. Those were mortgage investments on projects that have now been completed. So if the roads are falling apart now, that 2003 and 2005 money is not the source of how you're going to fix the problems we now face.
All right, last question. You know, back when people were debating Sound Transit and the light rail, people said, look, you're going to put all your bonded capacity, you can put all your money into this light rail system, and when the time comes to figure out other ways to pay for transportation, we're not going to have the money. Were those people right?
Well, I, in some respects, came close to being one of those people. And so I have that concern. On the other hand, we are today where we are. We're not back making decisions that we've already made. So the real question we face today is, with the sources of money that are now at hand, including the considerable sum of money that now comes into Sound Transit, how can we best balance our resources? How can we best balance our tolerance and appetite for more revenue against the needs we actually have to make this system work? And that's pavement, it's getting freight places, it's getting people back and forth across Lake Washington, it's keeping I-5 as the lifeline for our entire region. Those problems aren't going to go away. We have some money coming in. We're going to need more. How can we do what we need to do with what we could get, and how are we going to best use what we already have? Now, that sounds like a big agenda, and it is. And that's why the legislature and Governor Inslee have got some big challenges in front of them.
This is going to be a very urbanized, more urbanized than it is now in 20 years. This place is going to be one mass of bridges and freeways and people driving around.
Well, it's going to be a lot of different things. Don't forget that one of the things that's going to change is technology. One of the things I can't understand as kind of a transportation geek is, why is it that people think that the cars we're going to drive 20 years ago from now are the cars we drive now? The roads we should be building today are the roads we wished we built 20 years ago. There are going to be changes in how we work, what cars look like, what the size of cars is, how they work on the roads, how efficient roads work. And I wish all those things were being discussed too, because if we're going to plan for the future, we should plan for the future, not plan for the past.
Doug McDonald is former State Secretary of Transportation, and he's a Crosscut writer. I appreciate you coming in.
Always a pleasure.
All right, now we're going to take a look at Boeing and the Boeing SPIA leaders' decision on the Boeing contract. Boeing engineers have the option to strike over benefits now. This morning, we're going to take a look at the decision from a labor perspective. Dan Jacoby is professor of School of Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences at the University of Washington. He studies labor issues. Dan Jacoby, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
What's SPIA's contention in this issue?
Well, I think the biggest issue that I understand is around the pensions, where there's a desire on the part of Boeing to change the pension arrangement from a defined benefit to a defined contribution for new members.
Who benefits if the SPIA engineers say, "All right, we're gonna threaten to strike. We approve the idea of a strike," which is where we're at right now.
Well, it certainly gives SPIA leadership a stronger negotiating hand.
But does it hurt them in any ways at all?
If they hurt the engineers, I think that if they have the authority to strike, then they will be just in that stronger position for the negotiation.
The Boeing company said, "Look, we're laying down our marker here, and we're not going to make any changes. These are public negotiating tactics at this point." But
there's been a lot of brinksmanship along negotiations.
Does it make you nervous at all, as somebody who observes this, what it could mean for the engineers' union and the future of their place here in the Northwest?
Well, I don't really see how long run Boeing can't but rely on the engineering staff that it has. It has a very strong, capable engineering staff, so it's going to be hard for them to think about shifting work in any major way, especially given all the problems that they've had around or outsourcing today.
So union leaders representing engineers at Boeing, they voted to include strike authorization on ballots. They go to members next week. Members have until 5 p.m. on February 19th to cast their vote. Boeing's in the midst of a crisis over the 787. I can't imagine they would like a strike at this point. So perhaps it puts the company in a weaker position. But, you know, there's many aspects to negotiations. And the larger frame of things, this is about outsourcing. This problem with 787 seems to be about management and management approaches. Do you think this contention with the union is part of that same, I don't know, attitude?
Well, I think it is. I mean, there's been this back and forth history on whether or not there's an ability to develop a good working relationship with the unions. And for a while, it looked like they were beginning to turn the corner. And at this point, if we're back in this situation, this sense of not working as a team and working cooperatively to solve the problems seems to be heightening again. And that is a problem for Boeing, and it's a problem for the union, for everybody.
Is the union in any way asking for too much? The pension obligation, unions arguing, look, they got a lot of money. The company has money to spend in other places. They should pay attention to their workers. Or is the union needing to take a hit here to keep the company solvent?
You know, I think that the union's in the best position to be able to deal with those kinds of questions. Ultimately, it is a negotiation. If there's a way to make that work for both parties, then they're going to have to find that. But it seems to me that, the concerns that Boeing has, I think particularly in this environment where the interest rates are relatively low, that's not a permanent condition that interest rates are going to be this low. That's what's affecting their ability to pay out pension funds at this moment in time. And you know, in the larger scheme of things, we're looking at trying to figure out how to make adjustments around pensions. But the movement to defined contributions is really important to everybody. Already, there are fewer and fewer employers that provide defined benefit plans, and most of them have shifted over to defined contribution plans. But the protection of people for the long run really does depend upon having some security that the plan's going to be there and not vulnerable to ups and downs in the market.
This is still a strong union in a country where union membership is declining, as you well know. What would a strike at this point mean, pro and con, for the union movement?
Well, I think, you know, it signals on the plus side, the workers are still willing to make a stand, and that they sense that there's an important issue at stake. On the downside, as you've suggested, the possibility of a strike could further damage Boeing's reputation and its reliability. And if it ends up that there's a long-term cancellation of orders, that would be bad for everybody.
Dan Jacoby teaches labor classes and economics at the University of Washington. I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks much.
You're listening to Weekday.
It's 9:25, a conversation with New Orleans music legend Dr. John in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, an independently owned wealth advisor, committed to balancing clients' financial well-being with their personal fulfillment, providing customized financial planning, investment strategy, and trust management services. On the web at LairdNortonWM.com.
49 degrees and partly cloudy in Seattle, a little bit of sun out there. Forecast says it's going to turn mostly sunny this afternoon, and we expect high temperatures in the low 50s. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:26. The play A Day in the Death of Joe Egg is a theatrical take on parenting a child with special needs. It's being performed here in Seattle. We're going to learn more about it in 20 minutes.
But it must have been the wrong time. I done said the right thing, but it must have used the wrong line. I've been on the right trail, but I must have used the wrong car. Hit us in a bad place, and I wonder what it's good for. I've
been in the right place. Dr. John has been in the right place and the wrong place, but it's always the right time for his music. Five-time Grammy Award winner, has been playing music since he was a teenager. He got to play with and learn from the legendary Professor Longhair. Dr. John's stage presence grew out of his connection to a New Orleans faith steeped in voodoo. His personal life has been full of ups and downs. He has 11 children and grandchildren that he says he neglected during his touring years. His latest album, Lockdown, produced by Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, has him playing a Farfisa organ while he sings of revolution, the scourge of crack, the debt he owes his offspring, and the goodness of God. He is performing tonight through Sunday night at Jazz Alley. We got to talk to him before his first sound check. He has been an addict, a petty thief. He's been to jail. He has been shot and stabbed and generally been in the rough and tumble business of the music business.
We'll never call this an industry or anything like a business or anything else. It's a racket.
It was a racket run by racketeers?
And, oh, yeah. Listen, I was producing records. I was an A&R man. And I was a songwriter.
We're talking with Dr. John McRebenek. Say, when you're not on stage, how do you like to be introduced?
I have so many names. It's to different people. It doesn't matter.
Well, you know, I was reading that Dan Auerbach, who was the producer for Lockdown, he said he wanted to get the music of McRebenek on record. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you? What was he talking about?
Listen, Dan. Yeah, listen, I'm going to tell you, Dan is good. One reason I love him as a record producer, he's an original thinker guy, and he's very open-minded. He remembered a lot of things that when he came to New Orleans and just started talking to me one day, and then we started, he said, well, let's go write some songs. And we sat over at my pad, and I had a piano over there, just like he, and we just started writing some songs. We didn't use any of them.
So what do you hear in that record? I mean, how does it sound different to you than your past records? You're playing a Farfisa. You have
that,
a different group.
Listen, that was an instrument I hated.
Is that right?
I literally hated a Farfisa. Listen, when I worked and played with Sir Douglas Quintet years, and you could go back in the 60s, and Doug had this record out about Jezebel. And I would play that instrument for those two songs, Just About to Move and whatever the other hit he had with that instrument was. But I walked into Dan's studio. I didn't know what this thing was, and I just started playing it. And Dan said, "You're going to play that on this record." And I thought it was kind of cool. I didn't know what the hell it was.
When you were writing the lyrics, you had the tracks in your headphones or in the speakers you were listening to? Like this, I was looking at some of the lyrics for Revolution. I mean, that's a pretty radical song. Blind eyes of justice, deaf ears of power. Baby's women rape. Dr. John is talking to us, Mac Rebenack. You know, speaking of amends to your children, that's what you've said part of this record is about. Lockdown, this new record. In what ways?
Well, I just spoke to truths in a lot of ways. And I look at all of my children and grandchildren. They had little angels coming up. As I came up in the spiritual church in New Orleans, and the spiritual church, everybody was welcome. They didn't care if you was Hindu. Just, I say the lyrics in a song called Kingdom of Business. I say, it doesn't matter if you're a Hindu, a Mason, a Jew, or if you're a Christian, whatever you are, it's okay. You know what? Voodoo, whatever you do, it's fine. And what other church ever did that where the children were angels, could go play on the altar, anything they wanted to do? The women were saints and the men were workers. It's totally unlike any other church, but it was a good church.
Are you still in a church like that?
They don't even have such a church no more.
But we met one of your children. He talked about the spiritual connection you both have.
Oh, yeah.
Based on the faith, that faith?
Well, it's based on, listen, the spirit kingdom and the meat world. If we accept it through the spirit kingdom, we are given life. We breathe the breath of life. Everything that comes from the spirit kingdom guides us to the path we need to be on. We just have to know things. All I had to say, taught me a lesson, brought me a blessing. God, don't be guessing.
Yeah, I was looking at the cane because that's more than just a walking stick for you, yes?
Oh, yeah. It's way more than just a walking stick for me. It's there's lots of things. And I have things on here. Ricky from the Blind Boys of Alabama gave me this. My grandson made this. This is a 17-foot alligator's tooth that was extracted by my uncle. On and on. But this is, everything is on this. This is friends of mine's ashes. And so three of my friends, actually. It's Kane, and that's Earl King, and it's and Al Sedilla's ashes.
What's it do to have these here with you, and also?
It's a good touch with the spirit kingdom. You see, it's right here to let you know. See the skull? It's right there over that. And that's one version of what used to be in the meat world. And this is it in the spirit kingdom. And these are bones. These are all good things. Bones. I have lots of bones on here. It's a key to kingdom and a bell. It's a microphone.
Yeah, a like something that Elvis would have carried, right? Rhinestone microphone. Hey, you know, your last few albums earlier were about New Orleans. What happened to New Orleans? And some of the lyrics were you were a mad person. You did not like seeing what happened to that town.
Listen, after Katrina, I was very angry at the politicians. I was very angry at a lot of other people. I think I spoke my mind and I told the truth.
How do you think that town is today? How's the soul of that town today?
Listen, the soul of the people is good, but it's still the whole Lower Ninth Ward. I know so many people all over the United States and even other countries that have, that the politicians tore their home they were rebuilding down. Here's people rebuilding their roots, and it was just torn down.
But you guys like you and all the other musicians that stayed and cared, the question was whether New Orleans would come back, and you guys helped bring it back, helped keep it there, I should say.
Listen, I'm wearing a t-shirt that a guy from right here made, and it makes me happy. It says, New Orleans is bent, but it's not broken. And he made these for the Musicians Clinic of New Orleans, and the Musicians Clinic was there before Katrina. It's the only one of these organizations that got formed after, that was way before. And I loved them for that.
You know, bent but not broken, reading your biography, that could be your... That's, the t-shirt belongs on you.
Hey, listen, I've been shot through this knee, shot here in my butt. I've been shot through this finger, and the police broke all the bones in this foot. Everything else happened on my left side. I've been shanked 3 times in my left side.
What? When you were in prison or out of prison or just...
Yeah, a lot of time. Like, life is like that. This is just when you're ripping and running for drugs and stuff like that, anything can happen. That's what I could tell you. When you get in that game, and that's a game, and the ends is always the same. Jails, institutions, and the death. There's no other ends to it. And that's it.
That's why I say bent but not broken.
Hey, listen. I got a good side to me. And it's all this side. But right now, I went to a doctor, and he's helping me to be able to hoof better with this leg. I don't deal with the American Medical Association too much. I'll deal with them a little bit. But basically, not too much. I deal with a lot of... But see, my grandmother was a root doctor. You know what a root doctor is? Well, that was my grandma, and she was a good one.
Your grandmother was a root doctor, and your grandfather was the one... He was a musician?
He was sang with the Al C. Fields minstrel shows, and he taught me a lot of songs when I was a little kid. And I remembered a lot of them, but I had a lot of my family to help me remember them.
Over the years.
Oh, yeah, my Uncle Joe and my Aunt Martis and my Aunt Andre and a lot of them. And my mom and everybody in my family was pretty, had a good thing.
What about your kids? They following in music?
Hey, listen, my son here plays great guitar, he plays good bass, he plays good drums, he plays good. I just want him to get his chops back up so he's playing again.
Yeah, that's what you say. You say in this record that you're making amends for not spending a lot of time with them growing up.
Of course. Listen, when you're out working in a lot of places, I worked over a lot of years. I mean, I'm going to tell you, thank God my pa told me, I was failing school, and I got kicked out of three schools. I got kicked out of Jesuits, Warren East, and his Sacred Heart schools in New Orleans. And my pa said, "Kid, I want you to get this. You're smarter than to get 40s in your subjects and stuff." And he says, "Look, my advice to you is take this gig on the road." And you know what? That was the best piece of advice anybody ever gave me. And I went out on the Chitlin circuit with these old guys, and it was good. I learned a lot. And then I even went back to a musical school that I wasn't even eligible to go there because I never graduated from. We got to ninth grade, and that was that. So I went back to musical school at Loyola University. And Mike Karuba, who was the principal there, let me go in there. But unfortunately, we had got kicked out of there too because we were selling drugs to the jazz lab band. It was all strung out because me and my boy Charlie was selling them drugs. But hey, we was trying to make a living and survive.
You said that you didn't see this record as like a valedictory record. Like, you know, okay, here I am. Thanks, good night. This is just a new iteration of your work, this lockdown.
Hey, everything is, to me,
it's always the future.
Yeah. It's always the right now. The present is the gift. And when you live in the present, you know you have things to do in the future. That's just the path. It's good. Life is good. We all just gotta get a chance to live it.
Dr. John and his all-new band perform January 31st, February 3rd at Jazz Alley in downtown Seattle.
Dr. John on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:42, a theatrical take on parenting a child with special needs in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the State Utilities and Transportation Commission's Consumer Helpline, helping residents with questions about phone, energy, or water service, providing answers to billing disputes, service complaints, disconnections, and more. 888-333-WUTC.
This week on American Roots, we're down home in the big city, New York City, that is. Multi-instrumentalist Andy Statman explores bluegrass, klezmer, and free jazz. Then singer-pianist Nora Jones shares the countryside of life with the Little Willies, plus a lot of citified country songs and down-home urban tunes. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Sunday night from 8 to 10.
KUOW and City of Auburn present L.A. Theater Works, performing Pride and Prejudice at the Auburn Performing Arts Center on Saturday, February 9th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit our events page at kuow.org.
It's 47 degrees and partly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny this afternoon with a high of 51. And tomorrow, Saturday, some morning clouds and fog, then mostly sunny again with a high of 53. We'll get a more detailed and scientific weekend weather forecast from Washington State climatologist Nick Bond in about 15 minutes.
Now a theatrical take on parenting a special needs child. We know raising a child with special needs requires teamwork from the parents. The play, A Day in the Life of Joe Egg, is about the day when all that parental togetherness collapses. Should theater be encouraging such difficult conversations, Katie Sewell?
I asked that question to Terry Edward Moore, who stars in the production, A Day in the Death of Joe Egg.
Did I say Day in the Life?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, he's also raising a child with autism. So I asked him to give a brief overview of the production.
It's about a marriage that is, in many ways, very healthy, very funny, loving couple. But they've lived for 10 years with a severely disabled daughter, and the strain is beginning to show on the marriage.
That boy was cured.
Certainly improved. But I'd rather have nothing than a lot of lies.
But it could have worked. He might have magicked her.
I'm sure it was better to stop it then than later.
Where does the title come from, A Day in the Death of Joe Egg?
There are several references in the play to the fact that the daughter in the wheelchair just sits about like Joe Egg. Apparently that's a fairly common British phrase for someone who sits around doing nothing. And I realized in the process of working on the play that even though the daughter's name is Josephine, and you may think initially that she is Joe Egg, and that she dies. But what dies on this day is the game that the name Joe Egg represents. The games are the ways that this couple has kept each other amused and above the strain for these 10 years. And this is the day the game dies.
When the dam breaks,
so to speak. When the dam breaks, yeah. This is the day. I had a wonderful clown class many, many years ago, and the teacher said a thing that I've always remembered, that what we love about clowns is that clowns always fail and then get right back up and try again. All of us fail frequently, of course, and we love to think that we too can get back up and dust ourselves off and try again. What I love about the couple in this play is that they're brilliant at this. Yes, they have a lot of stress, but yes, they keep getting right back up and cracking another joke and cracking each other up and going on. But that this is the day when those brilliant coping techniques finally prove to be a little bit inadequate.
Now, it's my understanding that you actually have a special needs child of your own.
I do. My son is autistic.
How does that change how you view this play?
Well, it certainly gives me an appreciation of some of the nuances on a whole different level, that the kinds of disagreements that can grow up between the parents about, you know, whether to do this, whether not to do this in terms of treatments or various kinds of things, is very, very hard to always stay unified about those things. It's impossible. So how do you work through the times when you're not unified, and how do you cope with that? And you can't ever go back and try it the other way to see, you know, whether that would work better. You know, that's not one of the options you have.
How old is your
son? He's 14 now.
14. So you've had a lot of years to work on the negotiation together.
That's right.
How has it changed over time? I mean, we're looking at this couple's relationship for, what, 10 years?
10 years, yeah.
So now you're at 14.
Now we're at 14. Well, like with the couple in this play, laughter does help. If you can manage to crack each other up every once in a while, that makes a lot of things better. But you just have to keep trying. The couple in this play has, Brian and Sheila, have a little bit of trouble with being stolid British people in the 60s, you know, who weren't in therapy and not very good at dealing with emotions, communicating emotions, is that they didn't really tell each other a whole lot about what was really going on with themselves. So a lot of things were unexpressed and therefore not dealt with.
Is that the catalyst for why everything goes awry?
I think
on this
so.
Particular day?
I think so.
So
yeah.
Do you find that, I know this play was written in 1967. So
right.
Do you find that parents are getting more support than what's depicted in this play today?
Some. Not a whole lot, maybe. Certainly, I'm glad that it's not 1967 in terms of how my kid is being dealt with. A lot more therapies, a lot more, tools in society. I'm sure the schools are much, much better. But the resources for parents, not so much. Some, I'm sure. There are organizations of various kinds. But it's hard. There's a lot of isolation, partly because it can be difficult to find babysitters, for example, who are sophisticated enough in whatever disability you happen to be talking about to be able to deal with some of these kids, so you don't go out.
Terry Edward Moore is the producing artistic director of Talia's Umbrella, a new professional theater company, and they're performing the play A Day in the Death of Joe Egg at ACT Theater now through February 17th. What advice, I mean, this is stepping outside of the theater and talking more about being the parent of a child with autism, but what advice have you gotten that's actually been very helpful?
Wow, that's a great question. It's fundamental, I guess, that one isn't how you deal with your child, and one is how you deal with each other. In terms of the second question, first, as the saying goes, it's a marathon and not a sprint. And so part of what you need to do is learn how to take care of yourself and take care of each other. Put on your own oxygen mask first and then help the child next to you, sort of thing. But that's also, in a way, what you need to do then with the kid. Listen a lot and try to figure out what he needs rather than what he wants. That's never an easy thing to do with any kid, whether they're autistic or not. But that's the game, I think.
Are there unexpected joys that you wouldn't have thought?
Oh.
Or that you wouldn't have found, maybe, in a kid who, I don't know, was your average kid, or whatever that is?
Absolutely. I have one of each. I have one, what I like to call a normal syndrome child. I used to say for many years that there was nothing I could do outside the house with both of them at the same time except go eat pizza because they were so different. But my younger son is an amazing person, and his visual spatial imagination is something that absolutely blows me away. He creates these elaborate three-dimensional realities in the computer, look at that and just, I have no idea how even begin doing what you just did in 5 minutes. And you meet some extraordinary people, therapists and caregivers of various teachers. Some of his teachers have been amazing people, but also other parents who have good war stories and are amazing people because of what they've been through.
Well, going back to the theater, is it important for theaters to encourage heavier conversations?
I'd certainly think it's part of it, yeah. That's not the only thing theater can or should do, but one of my teachers once said that community is a group of people who all know the same stories and tell them over and over. So I like to think of the theaters in this town, in this country, as the storytellers who tell these stories over and over and help remind us who we are and who we can be.
Terry Edward Moore is involved in A Day in the Death of Joe Egg at ACT Theater now through February 17th. You can find tickets and more information at acttheater.org. And they're also having two shows that have discussions about raising special needs kids after them. And that's on Sunday the 3rd and Sunday, February 10th. Is there anything you want to say about those particular shows and why you're doing that?
I'm hoping that parents and other caregivers of special needs kids will be interested in the show and come see, and it might help to have an opportunity to talk afterwards with each other. And I've invited family therapist and a parent coach, both of whom have experience with special needs families, to come be part of those conversations. And I'm fascinated to see where those conversations will go. I haven't never done it quite this way before, so it'll be fun to see.
A Day in the Death of Joe Egg, acttheater.org. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you, Katie.
And now,
this is the sound of the week.
Of the shower dripping. That's the sound of the shower dripping. And then the sound of the pressure release in the pipes once the shower is turned on. Weekday listener Barbara in Mill Creek recorded that sound, just showing us how strange everyday sounds sometimes are when they're taped. I just say again that if anybody wants to go to the back of the communications building at the University of Washington and stand over the drain in the little plaza there and start talking and record that, you will feel like you have entered into Alice in Wonderland. Send us a sound, will you? Weekday at KUOW.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. The sound of this day is people going, oh, at least it's not raining. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist, works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with a weather outlook and a little bit of the science behind the weather. Of course, in many places, people are going, why hasn't this fog lifted yet? Isn't that right, Nick?
Yeah, it's kind of hanging in stubbornly in the South Sound, but I think it will be giving way to a very nice day with sun, mostly sunny skies, a few higher clouds drifting overhead, and Saturday an encore performance with maybe even less fog in the morning. And one thing on these nice mornings, a lot of times there's freezing temperatures around, and only the coldest spot should get down to freezing this weekend. And so, yeah, really pretty nice starting out. Sunday, a little cloudier, but still only a low chance of rain in the Puget Sound Basin. So, yeah, the foreseeable future, pretty good. Our next chance for legitimate rain is on Tuesday, and that's a lot better than illegitimate rain.
Yes, I was thinking the same thing. You know, you were saying that, you know, it's not very exciting, this weather, but yesterday, yes, it was rain, but especially if you're a bike rider or a walker, it's one of those days where you are basically immersed in a mist for the entire time you're outside.
Yeah, and especially if you're, you know, have any sort of goggles or sunglasses on or something, you're just kind of blinded in a minute trying to ride through that stuff.
Yeah, that was it was part of the many, it was one of the many names for rain because of the one of the many styles of rain we have in this area. All right, you were looking a little broader, though, the rest of the nation. What's happening in some interesting places weather-wise around the country?
Yeah, well, one thing that has caught my interest is just how the midsection of the country is doing. Last summer's drought and extreme heat was in the news, of course, a big deal. And so look to see how much precipitation they've gotten in the last month and season and so forth, because it turns out that the precipitation this time of year has a lot to do with how much it rains during the growing season. And that's through the effects on soil moisture.
That's fascinating, really. So soil moisture affecting later precipitation amounts.
Yeah, it turns out there's a fair amount of recycling of the water in that region and a lot of other places in the world during the growing season. When the soil is wet, there's enhanced evaporation, extra clouds and showers, and it just kind of it keeps wet. When it's dry, there are fewer clouds. The sun more heats up the ground rather than evaporates water. The relative humidity goes down and just kind of perpetuates itself. And so, unfortunately, while the lower Mississippi Valley in the last month has done okay, the Great Plains and Midwest as a whole for the last 90 days or so has only gotten about 50% of its normal rain. So it's not good news right now. There's exceptional drought from North Texas to South Dakota. So the Great Basin states really, the Great Plains states really in hard times now. So that's not looking so good.
This drought has gone on for a while in the Midwest, huh?
Well, yeah, it really cranked up last year. The year before it was in Texas, and so it kind of shifted north from the kind of maybe from the wheat belt to the corn belt. But, you know, we have it pretty good around here. Our snowpack is still near normal to slightly above. And so, you know, we should feel fortunate.
Yeah. All right, and what does it mean for their next summer's wheat crop?
Well, I don't know, but certainly the folks in that region have to be concerned. And there's a lot of time for things to come around, and you know, there's plenty of winter and spring left before the growing season really starts, but still it's not off to a great start.
All right, Nick Bond, thanks a lot, and we'll enjoy the snow here, and we'll feel bad for them.
Yeah, there you go.
I feel bad for it, but we'll enjoy our snow. You have a good weekend, sir.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to us. Nick Bond talks to us every week. He's at the Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. He is the Washington State climatologist. If you do not If you have not yet become a member of our Facebook fan club, is it called that? I don't know what it's called. Just join us on Facebook, weekday on KUOW. We're putting different things up there, additional material, photographs, and you can also follow us on Twitter, weekday KUOW. Put some upcoming information on there, and also pretty soon we're going to be like Seth Meyers, and we're going to try to practice that 140-character joke regimen, right? We're going to get jokes in 140 characters. That's your goal too, isn't it, Bernard? That's your joke, to do that. That's good. All right. I hand it to you. We'll review the news of the week coming up.
It's 9:59. Tomorrow during the 9 o'clock hour.
Want to know how much it'll cost to fix up your car?
How expensive are these corrections that you're talking about making?
Pennies.
Okay.
Thousands of pennies.
Big. Well. Right, wheelbarrows full.
We'll talk about new cars, old cars, even the...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.